You're listening to the North Peace Roundtable Podcast, your weekly podcast about theology and the Christian life. Don't smile at me when I'm trying to record the intro, Cortland. Episode 133.
Wow.
I was trying to think of a significant thing connected to that number, but...
It's one bigger than 132.
Oh, speaking of significant numbers, I watched a thing about the eclipse.
Yeah.
So like 4-8. Mm-hmm. And the guy was like, do you want to know the significance of 4-8? April 8th, 4-8. And he said, you know what Exodus 4-8 says? I'm like, oh my gosh. If they will not believe you, God said, or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. The first sign, the eclipse seven years ago, the latter. So he's talking about the two, like the plagues, right?
Yeah.
So, but he was like, Exodus 4-8, April 4-8.
What about Genesis 4-8?
Yeah, and so the guy I was watching was like, just flipping his Bible. All right, Mark 4-8. And then just showing that you can literally make anything anything. Like, but anyways, that's not what we're going to do this morning.
Next topic.
Episode 133. My name is Andrew.
Well, actually.
Oh, okay.
No, just on that note, it's so funny because I read, I was just reading a book that was talking about Paul's writings. And the author's like, let me lay something out for you. So imagine John and his uncle is a very popular family therapist and actually has met with 60 couples. And the couples range with their challenges from the simplest of disagreements to really complex problems. And John, being the good therapist that he is, prescribes methods for each of these couples to navigate their problems. And he actually like writes it to them. John passes away, and you, as his grandson, find clips of all these writings, and you put them together in a volume because you'd like to commemorate your great, you know, grandpa's work on marriage counseling. But you don't have a complete set, and you mix it all up because it sounds great. You throw it together as a narrative, and then you start selling it. And then people, you know, 40 years later are talking about John's prescription for this issue when, you know, long ago that was not the case. And it was just, he just kept going on for like two pages. And it was super funny because you kind of dive into like, what does this marriage therapy have to do with New Testament writings? And like, these are Paul's letters. Like, he didn't have verses and chapters and numbers. Like, these were letters to churches and people to deal with problems.
Yeah.
And I just thought it's super funny. Like, yeah, we just will open, flip to a chapter or verse. I'm like, oh, see, this is what Paul was trying to tell us.
Yep.
It's like, actually, Paul was writing to a person who was having some real significant issues in the moment. And he was using...
You got one side of a phone conversation here.
Yeah. Like, but all that being said, episode 133, Leviticus 13:3.
Oh, no.
133. The priest shall examine the diseased area on the skin of his body, and if the hair in the diseased area has turned white and the disease appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it's leprosy.
So
sorry, folks. Anyways, with me as always is Corland.
Hello, hello.
Oh, gosh.
That was a rough opening.
This is terrible. And Cameron.
Yeah, it made me think of that Matt Damon. Name it. I know what to do about leprosy.
And thanks for tuning in. We're a little bit more polished usually. Not really. So we have one question that we're going to tackle, and it's not that long of a question. And then we thought we could just talk about sharing things that we've been learning recently or books that have been challenging us or anything that's on your heart. Don't you love it? Just share from your heart. If you hate this episode, this is a good plug to say this is why you need to send us questions. Because usually Tuesday, Wednesday, we'll text each other and go,
any questions?
Anything for the pod? So, no, I think it's going to be a good discussion. So here's the question. Cam sent this a couple weeks ago. Why does it seem like the church... This was a question to you. This is not a question you had. Why does it seem like the church has no issue using words like Easter, which has no Christian origin, and not focus more on resurrection? At my church, if we say Easter, we owe $5 in the offering plate. Was that for real?
Yeah, that's a for real thing.
That is nice. Hilarious.
That's a for real thing that their pastor initiated in this.
In our culture, that's one way to up your giving.
Yeah.
So we're behind budget. How can we do this?
Buzzwords. Yeah. Yeah. You say this word, you owe us.
Prophecy bingo.
Prophecy bingo.
Sounds like Catholicism.
So Easter's interesting because, and we'll get to like the origins of why we use that word. It's this, it's the same with Christmas. Every Christmas comes around and I have people ask me, why do we celebrate? Why do we call it Christmas? Why do we celebrate it on this, on December 25th? Was that when Jesus was really born?
Did Mary and Joseph have a tree in their little?
Yeah. And all that kind of stuff. And then, Easter, not so much, but I've heard this like, wait, why do the word Easter is not in the Bible? Why?
To be honest, I've never thought of it until this year. I was explaining what Christians celebrate Easter for, because she has had no concept, and I was explaining it, and I got to the point where I was going to talk about Easter Sunday, and I was like, I have no idea why we call it Easter.
Yeah.
Literally, it's just a word that I've used my whole life to describe this set of, 3 days kind of thing.
But the question made me think, I don't know, it's funny, the world of Christian news, right? Yeah. Which is not, but Stephen Furtick's church, red flag. But yeah, their PR director, public relations, said that in all of their invitations and in all of their, so this Easter, we're not using the word resurrection or blood or blah, 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 blah.
You can't see what happened. But when he said that, my eyebrows raised.
Yeah. Because they were like, it's just, we just want to remove any kind of stumbling block for people. I'm like, well, to say on Resurrection Sunday, no one's allowed to use the word resurrection. I'm like, I think you kind of missed the point of Easter. And then I saw there was a church in the States that, you know how you just come across stuff and I had to check, is this real? And it was real. There were due to bad weather, we're not doing our Easter Bunny skydive. So they would have a plane that, it was a mega church. They would have a plane that flew over the mega church and the Easter Bunny sky dove out of the plane and then handed out eggs to all the kids. And that was their Sunday morning, Easter celebration. So I'm like, okay, I don't know if I would go so far as to say you're not allowed to use the word Easter, but I go, I think some churches we've strayed off of the main narrative here.
Paul would be writing some letters.
But we're getting a letter because I'm like, okay, I get the idea of we want to make it clear for people, but to say you're not allowed to say the word resurrection, that's kind of the whole point of the Sunday. Explain resurrection.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I don't know if I would go so far as to say certain words you're not allowed to say. But also, we want to engage culture. I actually have no issue. I know churches personally, friends of mine, that they have a Good Friday service. They do an Easter egg hunt on Saturday. They do services on Sunday because they're like, we want to engage our community. Everyone in our community will come to an Easter egg. I'm like, sure, that's great. But it's not the main point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes we stray a little bit when it's like, yeah, the Easter Bunny died for your sins. It's like, no. Yeah. But I don't know. How do you guys feel about what churches do on Easter? And then we'll get to why do we even call it Easter? Do you think it's okay for a church to be like, we're going to have Easter eggs? Or is that ooh, that's crossing the line. You're missing the point. I'd be interested to hear.
I think... Yeah, the nature of where this question came from
is Elder Cameron. So,
I think that
yes.
Let me gather my thoughts. Where this question originated was from that church would swing the other pendulum.
Sure,
it is Resurrection Sunday. We focus on the death, sacrifice, and then the rebirth of Christ. And so they wanted to. I guess where they were coming from is that Easter was not a part of the Bible. It was something that was adopted by Christianity. And so they were maybe even identifying themselves as a church that, did it by the book. And it's funny because you kind of hear that, we're an early church, we try to mimic an early church. And so much of what we do in church doesn't originate from the Bible. So I think that was the slant they were going from. And I think that can get a little confusing for folks too, because for your average person just coming to church, or like Corlin, you said, like growing up in the church, like Easter has never been a trigger word that's caused anything. So I think you can kind of swing both ways, where it's like you completely remove the resurrection and you have Easter eggs, which is, I think, a problem, or the complete opposite way, where you try to maybe confuse folks with this idea of what church once was, not appreciating the fact that where church has evolved is not necessarily perfect, but it's not terrible in all aspects either. Right?
No, like, right.
But I do think there should be, I would lean more towards a reflection on the resurrection of Christ rather than
yes,
other show, because that all happens outside of the church anyway.
Totally. That's a good point. You know,
on Sunday here at North Peace MB, I really appreciated the way the team downstairs in the children's center had these stations of the cross, and it was done super cool. Not an Easter egg in sight. Not a kid sad about that. You know what I mean? Because I think their families, you know, did the Easter thing. Got them some chocolates. So
yeah, exactly.
Sometimes I think that churches can also swing the pendulum to becoming the parents of children also, and maybe not resourcing families in that way and trying to be everything to everyone. So I don't think it's bad if the church just focuses on the resurrection that day and leaves some of the fluff for home.
Yes, totally. Corlin?
Yeah, I think...
What was your upbringing like? Did you guys do chocolate, Easter eggs?
So we, kind of stuff? Growing up, we would have had like in my memory, I can remember getting Easter chocolates sometimes, but we never really did an Easter egg hunt. Like that's kind of where the line was. It's like, hey, well, there's chocolate. The bunny is fun to get a chocolate bunny, so we can, whatever. We'll get one of those cheap, like $2 ones.
I remember the, did you ever get the like solid?
Yep, that's the one that we got.
That was
the one that, like, the first day that you, like, bite into it and it's soft. The next day, it's just rock hard wax.
Yes. Okay, keep going.
They give you an ear and they put it in the freezer.
Because I remember, I would always be disappointed. You bite in, oh, it's hollow.
Yeah.
Oh. But when you got the salt, oh, baby.
So, so we did stuff like that growing up. I think.
He's alive.
I think for me right now, like, I would.
Yeah, you got two young ones. What are you going to do?
Yeah, it's an interesting tension in my own head and heart and convictions with these things. Cause I do think that when the church comes together to celebrate the resurrection, personally, I think there's absolutely no space to have Easter bunnies or Easter eggs or chocolate. Like to me, I think that that's to call ourselves to remember what Christ has done and yet have what the world does thrown in there in that specific moment, I don't think is appropriate.
Yep.
But at the same time, me and my family do an Easter egg hunt for our kids. We do it separately. We call it an Easter egg hunt. And I think for me, the tension comes from like what we said, what I said earlier. I grew up knowing that Easter, in my context, like I said, it was literally this year when I was explaining to someone that I realized I had no idea why I even called it Easter.
Yeah.
So yet I was still celebrating the resurrection of Christ. So I don't think you could say that someone's celebrating the resurrection of Christ without any knowledge of what Easter meant before or could have meant before, I should say.
Yeah.
Then I don't think that you can just say, well, you heathen, you did like you're a worshiper of pagan gods. It's like, hold on. Like that's, I don't think that's accurate. I think the tension for me then comes, like, for example, with my coworker who had no concept at all about what Christians celebrate with Easter. Had she come to me and been like, hey, you're a Christian, do you celebrate Easter? If I said yes in that conversation, she would have no context as to what I meant when I said yes.
Sure. Yes.
She would think only in her context, which is fair.
The eggs and the bunnies. And,
Right. So then, of course, the conversation is about what I do with my children and stuff on Easter with the Easter egg hunts. And that, I think, is a tension that we would have to address if we or when we use the word. Right. So,
Yeah. So like then to talk about, okay, why do we call it Easter? It's interesting. I was sharing Corlin before we hit record. Before we were going to talk about this on, you know, Instagram, you scroll random things and there was a, this guy who's a, I'm a professor and blah, blah, blah. And he said with like a lot of confidence, this is exactly where Easter comes from. This is what we celebrate. It's a pagan holiday that da, 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 da. But actually when you do a little bit of research, there's a lot of confusion and unknowing of where exactly does this word come from? There is There's one writing in the 8th century.
By the Venerable Bede is what they call him.
There you go. The Venerable
Bede. B-E-D-E.
Bede. Yeah, okay. Not like a... Yeah. But he mentioned that there's a goddess, Istre, E-O-S-T-R-E, that was worshipped, and she was the goddess of spring and fertility, and that's where we get our word Easter from. But the problem is that he's literally, that's literally the only place.
It's like four sentences.
Written in all of 8th century writing that that goddess is mentioned. And if you do a little bit of digging, you're like, oh, this goddess Istre is not mentioned literally anywhere else. So could it be that? Yeah. But again, then there's all, it's fascinating.
There's like, a lot of scholarly debate as to whether or not he was talking about something real or if he had just been like, well, I've heard of this. So yeah.
And then
the Easter Bunny,
the word Passover in Latin and Greek, the root word Pâques, which is the French word for Easter. There's all of these like etymologies of where words come from.
Yeah.
They're like, maybe it's a Latin word in albis, which is Easterum, and all these kind of things. Maybe it's this, maybe it's that. So all that to say, no one's 100% sure where this word Easter comes from.
Also, only Anglo-Saxon Christians that use that word to describe Easter. Like, it's only...
Sure.
It's only...
That's because of the origin. Like,
yeah, it's because of the way words work, but anybody else, most other Christian traditions don't call it that if you're celebrating in a different... Especially a different language.
I think it's rooted in Constantine. and really, if you look into that, I'm sure you have even through school, like the origins of... The Christian church is really, people would argue whether he was even a Christian or not, but sure. He essentially formulated the idea of a Christian Sunday and everything. And then obviously there's so much influence around that nothing was kind of reinvented. They would redeem a lot of practices, and there's a lot of different ways where other religions would worship their gods. And here we have a group of people a few hundred years later expressing themselves in worship to the God of the Bible.
Sure.
And they did adopt some systems that were not, I think they worked to redeem some systems. And so, not necessarily evil in and of itself, but it could look similar across the board. And I think we see examples of that in the Bible and throughout history where, and that's why you have to discern, because you could see what could appear as the worship of God, and then you realize they're not worshiping God at all.
Right.
Yeah.
But their expressions look awfully similar to ours.
Yep.
And so I think really if you peeled back some of the layers of church history, you'd find that a lot of our systems or processes might mirror that of another, a pagan origin or a pagan tradition, but it's not that for us.
Yeah, and I think too, because even when you talk about Christmas, I was talking with a guy who I do not celebrate Christmas on December 25th. I do not allow my wife to go see her family because it's pagan. And his whole thing was like, this is rooted in paganism. I think you also have to be like really careful because like Easter, maybe, but again, it's like, there's actually some really interesting Jewish traditions about why December 25th was picked that has nothing to do with paganism. Yeah. It has to do with Jewish thought about prophets and when prophets were born and died.
Yeah.
And they picked a day that would make sense to their worldview. So and even this guy was like, but it's pagan. And I went, so? Like, who cares? Who cares?
Yeah.
Like, so...
Yeah.
I really like... go ahead.
So if you, celebrate Christmas on December 25th, if, 2,000 years ago or whatever, it was a pagan holiday and Christians said, we're going to celebrate on that day. I'm like, who cares? That doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. It literally means nothing.
Yeah.
You could pick January 15th. And probably go back in history and go, there was a pagan holiday on January. Like, this is like, who cares, right?
I think it's interesting when we as Christians hop on the bandwagon of being afraid that we're going to accidentally slip into pagan worship.
Sure.
Like, you think of how many things in our culture, in our society that we live through day in day, that we use day in day out, and we don't care about the pagan origins. Like the month January is named after pagan gods. The day Wednesday is named after a Norse, or after, what's his name? It's some, God that's Wednesday's named after, and it's just the word has changed slowly over time. But like, if you look at the root of lots of things that we do, there's paganism behind it. So do we just stop using the word Wednesday? Do we stop using the calendar because it's got January or anything? Like,
right.
Well, no, but chances are people probably didn't know that. So that, like, it's those kinds of questions that you got to ask yourself and say, okay, so like, at what point is Christ here to redeem the world? And at what point do we have to just skirt around all of the mess and never touch it? When, I mean, that's not even what Jesus did. Jesus was born into our world and walked with sinners, right? Like I was reading in Matthew where he is eating a meal. He just calls Matthew a tax collector, someone who people hated because of his job. And yet Jesus eats a meal with him and other known sinners.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pharisees point their fingers and are like, what in the world are you doing like with this scum?
Yeah.
And Jesus is like, no, like I'm here because they need me, right?
Actually, that's a very interesting thought, and I would like to capture it in a future episode, because I heard a lecture recently where people were challenging this missionary who was a bit of an urban missionary in the U.S. Who would go into remote communities and like just integrate himself with the community and try to share Christ that way, and they're like, you are not following any of the processes. You are not doing it the way we would define it.
Yeah.
And he said, actually, don't you remember, like, actually Christ inserted himself into a Jewish world, and like, not only inserted himself, like, became like the good one, like one of the best, one of the most knowledgeable. And through that whole time, through his entire ministry, reveal the nature of God to them and ultimately change the course of history. So he's like, for you to call me out on the way I'm integrating and sharing the love of Christ in this community because it looks very foreign to you, you're kind of going against the gospel. And I think that we could unpack that. Back to your thought on Christmas, I found it really interesting, and I wish we could adopt it here, but it's just too hard. But my wife, born in the USSR, grew up with New Year's as being Christmas in the sense of the gifts and the dinners and everything that. And that's how the most of Russia and the Eastern Europe celebrates Christmas. December 25th is their acknowledgement of the birth of Christ. And so even as my wife is introduced to Christ from her grandfather, even though it was illegal, they understood that's the birth of Christ. Have a solemn meal, nothing special.
And then
New Year's is all the presents. And so
that's cool.
Coming to Canada was the first time that she experienced Christmas presents on Christmas Day.
Hmm.
And we always thought, oh, that'd be great to do for the kids. It's just too darn hard here.
Yeah, it is.
When you're just immersed in what has become our tradition.
Hmm.
Yeah, so all that to say, I think it's one of those, like, so if you're a follower of Jesus and your conviction is like, nope, I'm going to call it Resurrection Sunday, I'm not going to call it Easter, okay.
Yeah, go buy cheap chocolate on Tuesday.
Sure, that's true. Yeah, that's actually really true. But I think it's one of those, adiaphora, which if you're not, I mean, it's a Greek word that just means it's a debatable issue. It actually doesn't matter. And now that's hard because for some people it's like, it does matter, but it actually doesn't. If you want to call it Easter, I think Paul would say, like, yeah, have at it. If you want to call it Resurrection Sunday, go for it.
Because we put our baseline on, is this causing us to sin before God?
Totally.
And is it causing us
to shun
the gift of salvation.
Yeah. If your conscience is like, I feel like I have to call it this or that. Yeah. I think go with what your conscience is telling you. Like, that's fine. Yeah. But then not to be like, you Christian, you call it Easter, I'm better than you because I call it Resurrection Sunday. No, I don't really think that's.
Because when people choose those positions, then they naturally gravitate to larger groups that share those convictions. And that's why we have 2,000 flavors of Christian tradition right now, because naturally as people we like echo chambers that are quite narrow.
Sure.
We like to hear our own ideas reflect back on us, and we're challenged by any kind of
Yeah.
Thought or question.
Yeah.
So where does Easter come from? We don't know. 20, 25 minutes to say. We have no idea. I don't know.
Yeah. Honor the resurrection, be thankful, and eat the solid bunny.
Can we just say, don't buy your kids the hollow bunny?
I like the chocolate from the hollow bunny better.
Oh my gosh.
The solid chocolate just doesn't taste as good. There's more of it, but
this will be the last episode.
That's because it was like the $1.97 one from Walmart you experienced.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. I can't deny it. It's true.
Get the one with the Rice Krispies in there. Then you got some. Now you're cooking.
All right, switching gears.
Nice transition.
Sound effect. This is a reminder to send in questions that you might have. But for the last couple of minutes before these guys have to go to work, we just wanted to open it up to what have you guys been reading lately or been challenged by lately? If there's like a book that you're like, this book has changed my life, or like a sermon that you listened to, mine lately, that changed your life.
Yeah, right.
Okay. I'm just joking. But it might be helpful for people, or even just to share, like, hey, this is where we're being challenged lately, or this is what, Corlin, why don't you start?
I like how you're explaining it, and then it just, never mind, just go.
Just say something.
Yeah, I think you were saying earlier when you brought this up, you're like, yeah, well, I guess we'll see how this goes. Come ready to talk. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You're asking like three guys who love to talk.
Yeah. I may have to talk
about our personal lives. Like, of course. Yeah. I think there's one book that I've been reading and really enjoying. It's a really, really slow read. It's quite a heavy read. It's called The Art of Biblical Narrative by Robert Alter.
Okay.
Yeah,
I've been struggling with falling asleep at night. It's been helpful.
Not gonna lie though, Cameron, I think most people probably would.
The Art of Biblical Narrative.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Robert Alter is he studies narrative. Now that's narrative, whether it's the narrative in the Bible or narrative in general, like if somebody's writing a story, like if you were to read Lord of the Rings or something like that, to study how people use narrative in artistic ways to convey messages through that narrative. It's been a fascinating read.
Is he a Christian?
I don't know.
Okay.
I actually don't know if
he is.
So
he's just like approaching the Bible, looking at it from like a narrative
point of
view.
That's why I say I don't know if it's just the narrative point of view or if he has a Christian background or if he is a follower of Christ. I'm not sure. I haven't gotten far enough into the book, and I've done some digging into him, but I haven't found anything yet that stately says that he's not a follower of Christ, but I also haven't found anything that says that he's not. I think for me, the interesting thing is when you look at because he's focusing mainly on Old Testament right now. When you look at those narratives, he does a good job at showing that it's not just a Bible story. It's not just like, it's not just, okay, A happened, then B happened, then C happened. He does a really good job at showing, hey, like, if you look at the Old Testament, the amount of times that the same A, B, and C happen, but with different character names, but it's the same story arc over and over, and the same lesson is being shown, the authors are actually expertly crafting these stories to show that, right?
Yep.
It's the same. He would compare it, I think, to the same as like when you tell a story and you want to put emphasis on one part of the story to get a laugh or to get a reaction out of it. It's not that you are not telling an actual story that happened. It's that you are focusing on something so that everybody else sees it. I've really appreciated it. I think for me, and even then when I go to do my devotions.
You're the pattern guy. Because even
patterns.
In our life group, you're like, the pattern guys, do you see the pattern?
And yeah.
Some people, I think that
it's overwhelming.
They don't care as much.
Yep, that too.
How do you feel about the pattern of the New Testament that it's not in chronological order, but it's just the largest to smallest?
Yeah. Does that drive you crazy?
It doesn't.
I think it's so fascinating because
but let's start with the stories of Jesus. We got to start there.
Yeah.
And then the story of how the church started. How are we going to organize all the letters? Biggest to smallest. What about timeline?
I think to me, because I know it's organized like that, it doesn't, to me, I don't care about that. Cause I mean, our Old Testament in most English Bibles is not in the same order that a Hebrew Bible would be in anyways. I think
was the Holy Spirit inspired or was it just a creation of the canon by human beings over a certain amount of time?
Both.
Both. Yes and.
Yes, the answer is yes.
Both and.
I think for me, the thing with patterns that like, whether it's Robert Alter that touches on it, the Bible Project does a good job of showing different patterns throughout scripture too, and there's other teachers too. I think the thing that I appreciate about that is that when I read scripture, it's really easy for me to disconnect from the stories and be like, this is so long ago, how does this happen kind of thing. When I read the stories and can recognize that they're true, but then recognize the truth that lies almost underneath the truth of the story and like what the authors are trying to show you about who God is or about the condition of humanity. Those are the things that I think for me make the difference. When I look at the patterns, like for example, it's like 6-7 years ago before I started following Christ again. One of the things that kept egging at me about the Bible was when I would look at how I was treating people or how other people were treating other people. And then I looked at how the Bible described how we treat people. That pattern was consistent. It was the only pattern that I could see was true out of texts or beliefs. It's like, hey, like people are going to sin. People are going to mess up. It's inevitable. But yet God is faithful and has a design. Like those kinds of elements, those patterns were things that laid underneath. So it's been a really interesting read. It's hard.
What's the name of it again?
Art of Biblical Narrative by Robert Alter. And cool. I've been, it's the kind of book where I have to like use a dictionary while I read it. Cause
nice.
Yeah. Like every three paragraphs, there's two words and I'm like,
It's important. Cause I think, the whole idea of like chronological snobbery, that we look back and we're like, you know, these idiots, you know, 5,000 years ago were writing on, writing on stone. But when you look at how the Bible's written, it's like, they were actually like really smart, and we're pretty arrogant when we're like those ancient cultures, like, they just write me make fire. I'm like, no, they were like brilliant. They're actually like maybe smarter than a lot of us today. So that's cool.
Yeah. So that's just like a knowledge thing. I think for me, the other thing that I've been reading and learning on a personal note would be I've been reading the Sermon on the Mount, studying that. And that's some convicting stuff. Like when you start looking at what Jesus says, so there's the Beatitudes and then he goes into the section where he talks about lust and anger and those kinds of things. And when you like on surface level read that, it can be quite convicting. But then when you start realizing how deep that actually runs into your heart. So just to share really quick personally, cause I know that you guys got to share quick before we're done anyways.
I'm good.
When you read where Jesus says, if you look at a woman with lust, you've committed adultery with her in your heart. As you guys know, because I shared last time on the podcast, coming back from struggling again with some issues with pornography and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because when you think of what Jesus is saying, there's at one point Jesus is asked to summarize, like, what's the most important commandment? And he gives, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your strength and all your mind. But then he adds another one. They didn't ask for two, but he adds another one and he says to love your neighbor as yourself. These, paraphrasing, this is Corlin's paraphrase, summarize the law and the prophets. Like if you look at the Old Testament, love the Lord your God and love your neighbor are the heart of it.
Yep.
And so if you think of what adultery is, if marriage is meant to mirror the gospel and God's love for us, any time in your marriage, whether husband or wife, you are choosing to invest your heart, your time, your energy, your mind into, even if it is just in your mind, being with someone else, you are not committed to that relationship.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's been hugely convicting then. Cause that doesn't just apply to sexual sin. That applies to other sins then too. Right. So when he talks about anger being the same as murder, right. If you're investing your energy, your time, and your mind into hating someone, it is the same as when you've committed murder in your heart, right?
Yep.
And so it's not, I think sometimes we can get the idea that Jesus is just like, well, it is just in a box, one step above what they would have taught. And it's like, no. He is teaching that it is in the same box, actually. He is in some ways raising the bar, but he's also saying, hey, these are actually the same. It's not just raising the bar to be like, hey, you can't get there. It's to say, hey, no, even with the law, you're not there, right? Mm. Like it is, it's one and the same. So that's been convicting as a follower of Christ to start realizing like when the Bible talks about us having hearts of stone and not being able to hear, it's amazing how patient God is with us as mm-hmm. he softens our heart and as he renews us, transforms us, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of been some of the stuff I've been meditating on lately.
That's cool.
Right on.
Cam, you're like in school and you do all sorts of, you're like, I don't want to talk about reading.
I was actually just thinking for this one course, like just one course, Intro to Ecclesiology, there was 6 books.
Wow. And for people who don't know, what is ecclesiology?
Just the origins of church.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
the origins of not even church as we consider an organized religion, but just where the birth of the idea of
totally
where we've come, which is quite fascinating. So my mind-numbing book is like the Intro to Ecclesiology, which Jeez. Is just massive. And then 5 other works that we had to read. And we do format papers. I don't know if you like, it's like you have to put the book into your own words.
Yes, right.
In 6 pages. We had to do that on 2 of them and then pick a reading of our own. So for that, I chose Paul's Idea of Community as yes. my own,
yeah.
which I kind of poked at a little bit ago, but that's been, really interesting in the sense of, appreciating and just kind of a throwback to our earlier conversation, like the way we do things today is fine by a lot of respects, unless you're the kind of church that's like, we're doing it by the book, you know, like we're doing it just like the,
yep.
well, we're not, and it's fine. But appreciating where these branches, stemmed in our context from Catholicism and so many of the traditions we kept, you know what I mean? Look at the Reformation as, wow, we carved a new path. It's like, no, you really didn't. Like, it mirrors so much to the way it was. And we could talk about that another time, but that's just been consuming that part of my brain. But
yeah,
I'm also in courses for work. So
okay.
I'm doing my CPHR designation, which is a chartered professional in human resources. So you have to take 9 university courses.
Sheesh.
And then have 8 years of experience. So I have the experience. I'm just halfway through all the coursework. And it's really interesting because I actually see more of my opportunity to reflect my beliefs through my work in a secular environment. Like, you know, at 8:30, I have a person come into my office who's struggling with addiction. And it doesn't work in my context, but I still have that opportunity to speak into, and they're only speaking to people's lives, and they're only coming because I knew 17 years ago I struggled in that way. So it's fascinating because as the HR manager for the city, I get random calls almost every other week of community members who go online and they look at human resources and my name pops up just because the city of Fort St. John, because of human resources in Fort St. John, and they phone thinking that we provide this service.
Oh, interesting.
Like, no, like I just work for the city. But it's created a couple of relationships where so much of that field is like the caring of people.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many opportunities to actually influence change from the context of a Christian perspective, and I really appreciate that. So
that's cool.
It's fascinating going through the work, and I often think like of a secular person who just may enjoy the career for other benefits, and like how do you actually speak into that person's life and create meaningful change without having a desire to love them? I feel like that would be near impossible. But it's funny because even through that, I'm far from holy in the sense where I still have to pray often, like, God, let me love people the way you do. Because sometimes it's just like, I've enough,
yes.
you know, like you're just done. And so I think that's been one of my biggest personal prayers is for patience and wisdom with my own family and the people in my life, but also the individual folks that I get an opportunity to coach and to mentor and work with. So I guess just back to kind of like the book I'm just finished, this Idea of Community, I just really appreciate how I think you mentioned this book. I think you read it a couple of years ago. Really just appreciating the nature of Paul's idea and Paul's methodology in the way that he communicated his conviction and he coached and raised up leaders. And I was reflecting on that a couple of weeks ago where someone was asking me for some advice, and they had to mention that they were going to this service and speaking with this person, and I know the person, they're a very softly spoken therapeutic counselor. I'm like, well, you're not going to get that from me, man. I think what you're doing is absolutely crazy. And it's funny because we had the relationship where I could be like, I'm going to have to call you out on that because I don't believe you, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And I appreciate that because I see some of that in Paul. Like, guys, like, despite what you've heard, you're all being nuts. Like, stop it right now. Right? he was not, from all accounts, someone who put the hand on the back. We see that kind of lovingly language, you know, to my blessed brother. But I think he was a lot more like, guys, are you crazy? Like, yes. I just left. What the heck is wrong with you, right?
I just left.
So, yeah, it's funny when you can work and reflect on some of the reading and think of it in that way. And
that's sweet.
Provides a little more depth.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have.
Yeah. Well, you know what Andrew's been reading. Fine, yeah. Sermon series.
Yeah. No, a lot of my reading does coincide with what we're preaching. So Book of Acts. But even our AGM's coming up in May, so I just went to our administrator and was like, how much is left in my book fund before it's gone?
Yeah.
So I just bought like 9 books or something like that because I'm like, I got to use it before I lose it. So one that really quickly, because I bought a few books about the Ten Commandments because future sermon series maybe.
Ooh.
But just interested about, I've never really done any like extensive reading. We all know, yeah, the Ten Commandments, but never really done some digging into like the significance of that. So that was cool. But Finding the Right Hills to Die On by Gavin Ortlund. I'm like halfway through, but basically he calls it theological triage. He gives the metaphor. He's like, okay, yeah, let's say you're in a war and you're in the medical tent, and triage is like, how do I figure out who gets treated first? And someone comes in with a broken arm, and yet this guy's bleeding out over here. If I deal with the broken arm, that guy's going to die. And he was saying, theologically, we do that. Like, what are the most important theological things to, in the context of a church, deal with?
Yeah.
And he says, lots of pastors then, you know, they're fixing broken thumbs when someone's got their leg chopped off. And he's like, and that's bad. So that happens tons. We got to deal with this issue when actually there's way more. So his whole book is like, how do you decide which things to address first? And like first tier things, second tier things. He has 4 first tier things, second tier things, third tier things, and then fourth tier things. Like first tier things are like the Trinity, you know? Yeah, we got to deal with that. That's pretty significant. Second tier things, he's like spiritual gifts, women in ministry. Those things are important, but they're not as important.
Yeah.
And then third tier things, he gets into like, you know, baptism. He classifies that as less important. And then fourth tier things are like, don't even waste your time on them because it's not, it doesn't matter.
It's an interesting metaphor because if you think of it, someone who has like their leg chopped off may have gone into such a state of shock that they aren't able to scream out in pain, and the person with the broken thumb would be the one doing the most whining. So you're like,
and man, oh, and man, it's like that in church too, ever, right? True.
the person who is spiritually dying, whose marriage is failing, who
I don't like the grape juice we use for communion.
Yeah.
Which literally was last week.
So
we shouldn't have the gluten-free table.
Yeah. But it was interesting because he kind of goes, most churches either what did he call it? He says doctrinal sectarianism, where we divide over third tier issues and fourth tier. He's like, it's just silly, guys, that we are dividing over these things. And then he says the opposite is doctrinal minimalism. And he says it's a lot of younger people who are like, who cares? No one cares. Who cares what you believe? It doesn't matter. And he's like, both are wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's like, how do you lead people when everybody's thing is very important to them, and to tell people, actually, your thing is not as important. I need to deal with this. So, and anyways, being a pastor, it's like, this is the world that I live in. So it's been super helpful.
One professor threw out a question to, sorry to interrupt,
this is good.
A question to the class. He's like, how much water do you need for baptism? Like, how much?
How many liters?
And I was just being like a bit of a jerk. I'm like, just enough, but not too much. And he's like, well, not too much. And he was kind of referencing that same thing, right? He's like, all of these cultures around the world
totally
understand their idea of baptism. He's like, he shared a story of a tribe, and I don't know where it was, but he's like, they bury the person, like just symbolically. They have a box, They throw some dirt on top, and then they Jeez. It's quick, he said, and they say their prayer, they take it off, and they rise out of the grave as a new person. Hmm. Born again into newness within...
It's the boo box. Anyone remember Hook? No?
No.
Put him in the boo box. Okay, sorry. Someone listening will remember the Robin Williams movie, Hook.
I've only seen it once.
Oh, Hook, yes.
Yeah, not the boo box!
Yeah. Anyways. So it was funny, it was just... So yeah, like we make a mess.
Corlin's like, I gotta go to work. Yeah. Oh. Anyways, this has been episode 133.
Thank Bye, Corlin.
And if you have questions or other things you want us to talk about, please send them in so that we don't have to do this again. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, we'll talk to you next time.